My name is Congressman Jose E. Serrano. I was born in Mayagüez, Puerto Rico. I came here at the age of close to 8, and I grew up in the South Bronx. I've been here all my life, and I live in the area that I grew up in. I mean, and I represent that area. I've been in public office now 43 years, longer than anyone in the history of the Bronx, and longer than any Puerto Rican under the American flag, including in Puerto Rico. Tony Fass, I have 2 years on him in service, and he is not running anymore. He stopped, so I first got elected in 1974. And I love what I do. I do a little jogging. I listen to music day and night in English, Spanish, and any language I can partly understand. I'm a frustrated singer, composer, comedian. But I got inducted into the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Comedy Hall of Fame for doing comedy night at some other nights. So I'm just a person who's a product of the South Bronx. I think you're classic New Yorkerican. Some people think New Yorkerians only the ones that were born here. But it's also the ones who were raised here. And this is what I know. I know the Bronx. I know New York. I'm a New Yorker through and through. But for the fact that you can live outside the mother fatherland and not lose who you are, because I'm part of that community that never stopped being Puerto Ricans. In fact, I once said it either in a dramatic, foolish, or poetic moment, that Puerto Ricans in New York are like pasteles. When we couldn't find the leaves to wrap them in, we wrapped them in paper. And so on the outside, Puerto Ricans and pasteles changed, but on the inside, they didn't change. New York lends itself for you to be a New Yorker. And that entails a lot of things. In other words, New York has a very, perhaps even conservative, Italian community, and yet they never stop being Italians. You know, and they celebrate San Gennaro, and they celebrate Little Italy, and so on. And the Irish, as we know on St. Patrick's Day, people whose great-grandfather was Irish are still Irish on that day, or they've got their mom is Irish, or their father's Irish, and so on. And New York lent itself to that, so people in New York don't have to lose their identity. In addition to that, New York is such a diverse area that it's very hard for you to, even if you wanted to, just remain one thing, because around you there are so many other different people that you become part of them. I mean, so much of what we, as Puerto Ricans, for instance, are things that we didn't eat when we came from Puerto Rico. We picked it up here. And then a lot of things, you see, for instance, Mexican food is so popular in the United States. Well, it's popular with a lot of people who are not Mexicans, you know, and so Chinese food and so on. It's the beauty of New York. New York is just a marvelous place. My dad, I'm told, I can't prove these things, ran under the Workers' Party label for a local office in Mayagüez. And my uncle, Guillermo, I understand, again, these are things that I heard through the family, but they can't all be made up, was very much involved with Alviso Campo. And I remember when we got older and I got into politics, he would talk to me about Muñoz Marín and Alviso and so on. There was so much. And these folks were not professionals, you know, they were factory workers, very honorable work, but they were not professionals anyway. My mother also discussed a lot of politics in the house. But what my mother did most of was sing in the house. She sang when she did the dishes, when she wasn't doing the dishes. She just sang all the time. Hipólita. Pola, Polita. And I remember, for instance, that there was a program on WHOM, which later became, I guess, another station, but it was, became WJIT and so on. se llama el debate musical, the musical debate. And what they did is every afternoon from 4 to 4:30 or so, Juan Rodriguez Diaz, this Puerto Rican locutor, this jockey, would pick two artists and send them off against each other. And some never lost. Felipe Rodriguez never lost. You know, Pedro Infante never lost. You know, and Etiolo Pancho never lost. You know, and what happened was you made a phone call on behalf of the artist you wanted. So my mother would take a dime and send me downstairs to the front of the building because we didn't have a phone to make a phone call. And I've always said that it was the smallest amount I paid for a cultural experience in my life, 10 cents. It was 5 cents or 10 cents a telephone. And you made a call and listened to it every day. But she took me from the time I was young. When we first lived for a year on the west side of Manhattan, she would take me to the Edison Theater, which was on 103rd Street and Broadway, to see Pedro Armendariz, Pedro Infante, Jorge Negrete. And then when a picture finally came from Puerto Rico, Maruja, which was made in Puerto Rico, that was a big deal. And we were living in the Bronx by then on St. Anne's Avenue. So we went to the Mecca, you know, to the Puerto Rico Theater. The Puerto Rico Theater was unique because you would have a movie and a stage show. And Chucho Avellaneda will tell you that he was in those early days with Paquito Cordero, and they would, a couple of artists would perform at Teatro Puerto Rico, then a car would be waiting for them. And while the second set of artists were performing at the Puerto Rico Theater, they took them down to the Jefferson Theater in Lower Manhattan to perform the beginning of that show. And they did this like 4 or 5 times in one afternoon. And you got La Taberna India, which was a great show. And then, of course, the Puerto Rico Theater, you know, when las novelas came on TV, you know, and television came, that kind of dwindled down somewhat. But years later, one person, I think, broke every record in the world, and that was Iris Chacón. There were lines around that theater, I remember, where you would be standing next to a person and you thought that you were in the same place where that person was. But no, that person was on line 2 and you were on line 3. You had to still go around the theater to reach the point where that person was. And the shows were just wonderful. Cantinflas, Tintan, Yolo Pancho, Lucho Gatica. That's where I got to see one of my heroes that I got to meet at Hostos College, Marco Antonio Muñiz, you know, and in fact, my son, his name Jose Marco, the senator, in tribute to Marco Antonio Muñiz. But then so is Mark Anthony,
yeah,
named Marco Antonio Muñiz. Right. In fact, that is his name, yeah, but his father named him. And when he stopped singing Con el Trio Los Tres Haces, and he went solo, he showed up you know, and then we saw all the young ones, you know, Lucecita and Danny, Chucho, and all that. They all showed up as these new stars from Puerto Rico, and they were mixed into the shows from Daniel Santo, Rafael Hernandez, and so on. And it was just wonderful. It was just wonderful. And one of the tragedies, which I really think, and I'm not saying this to butter you guys up, I think belongs at Hostos, is there were thousands of photographs in the basement. Nobody knows what happens to those photographs. There were thousands of photographs in the basement of the Puerto Rico Theater. And if they belong anywhere, they belong at Hostos College. Hostos became a cause more than a school. Just like now I say, if there's any school that has earned the title community, it's Hostos Community College, because it's a place, I mean, people use it for events. People use it for forums. People use it all the time. But Hostos became, for the younger people and for the older folks, it was a moment where, like, the Puerto Rican Parade folks got together with the younger folks and said, you know, we need a school, a bilingual school. And so the battle started. And getting it was easier than keeping it. because they wanted to merge it with Bronx Community College. And we had nothing against Bronx Community College. But by then I was in the state assembly. And I remember, you know, you try to remember these things as they were exactly. And you hope that someone doesn't show up and say, it didn't really happen that way. But I do remember that Bobby Garcia was the state senator. And I was the newly elected assemblyman for this area. And we held up the budget in negotiations with the chancellor, who was Kibbe. His name is Kibbe. Not to close, not to merge it. And we won. It didn't get merged. And there it is, growing every day. And as it also said, we've always kept trying to do things that are meaningful to the community. I know I'm jumping all around, but for instance, there was a time when people were sending us bricks, members of Congress, and the bricks were insulting. The bricks were, build a wall, build a wall, build a wall. So I got this crazy idea of taking the bricks, and instead of using it to build a wall, which I wasn't going to build, use it to build a monument to immigrants. And that sits at all sorts. I was able to get a small grant to begin something that has to keep growing. And that's the Tito Puente exhibit, and, you know, get from the family to allow us, you know, things that belong to Tito Puente. So all sorts became that place that people understood had to be our showcase, not only as a school, but also as a place for the community to come together. I've been with Osos long enough to remember when at the beginning you would go to graduation and make a speech. You had to make sure that the speech was half in English and half in Spanish. Now it's not a problem. You can make a speech totally in English at Osos and the vice versa. But it's always been a part of the community, and that's the difference. That it wasn't just a school. It became a struggle. It became a symbol of the Puerto Rican and later Latinos not giving up. But Puerto Ricans at the beginning saying, you know, we can have this, we can have this. We have a parade. We have baseball teams. We have organizaciones de pueblo, you know, hometown organizations. We need a school. We need a bilingual school. And that's where Russell's came in. What happened was it was budget time. So it was about this time. It was budget time. And the budget of the City University of New York called for saving money by merging Osos right. with Bronx Community College. And we felt that that was everything from insulting to improper to destroying our dream. And so I spoke out. And I was terrified because I was pretty new to the assembly. It wasn't my first year, perhaps, but I was pretty new. You know, it takes a while in a legislative body to get up and begin to say things. But Bobby Garcia was in the Senate, and he believed in the same thing. And so I remember, for instance, one day where the assembly members were out in the chambers waiting for something to happen on Osos because we were holding up the budget. We were saying, you know, we're going to go outside and make a big, strong speech if we don't get what we want. And we were inside of the speaker's office with the CUNY people, Bobby Garcia and myself, trying to get it done. And it got done. It wasn't merged. And the rest is history. Had it been merged, it would have disappeared. Is that the way Wally remembers it, too?
Yeah.
And it was a new institution. A lot of people didn't know what it was. You know, we would say hostels, they would say hostels, you know, but that was fine.
Right.
So, it was a crucial moment for Osos because it was in danger of disappearing. And people who didn't know the school as much as they should have, including myself, stood up for it because we understood what it meant, as we still do understand what it meant. In fact, if you were to ask me, this is the truth, it sounds dramatic, but it's true. If you were to ask me, name five things that you lost when you got to Congress. Right on top of that list would be the fact that I lost the ability to be here most of the time on graduation day for Osos because my schedule in Washington, he keeps me away for a lot of times from graduation day. But in the early days, I would miss one graduation at Austin's. Not one. I mean, and it was, I had something that I would always say that I felt, but it's still true for Austin's, and it would get a standing ovation. I would say, you know, I don't knock people who go to other schools, but while other people are finding out how many people can fit in a phone booth as part of the spring initiation, you're trying to find out who's going to babysit your daughter so you can come to school. While other people are trying to figure out where they're going for the spring vacation, you're trying to find out how you can cover your second job and your afternoon job, your night job and your afternoon job, and when to do your homework. One time I got daring, and I said two things which were daring, but they were received with standing ovations. I said, I don't know this for a fact, but you may be one of few students who has soiled homework paper, because most of the time you're doing your homework while you're feeding your baby. And there might be baby food on that. And I said, and it's not only looking for assistance in some cases, and I can't believe I said this, it's also looking for your missing husband, which is true. The average age of Austin in those days was 27. Now it's probably a little lower, or maybe
higher. Yeah, it's younger, early 20s.
Yeah.
Average.
But Austin was a place where you went back to school. It also became the place where people began to recognize in Puerto Rico. And I played a small role in that. I would tell these people who came for the Puerto Rican parade, they would call me up and say, listen, I'm going to be transmitting from New York. Do you know a place where I can transmit for? I said, call Austin's. I'm sure they'll give you a room to transmit the radio broadcast back to the island. And it happened in many cases. Radio Isa, Noti Uno, and others did it, because I felt that Austin was that important. And I still do. To me, Austin's is still a symbol of an accomplishment of a community. And most importantly, older, one generation of Puerto Ricans getting together with the younger generation of Puerto Ricans for the same cause. As happened with Lincoln Hospital, where so many people got arrested and so on. And Anita Antonetti has a lot of pictures of me, not only with Antonetti, but at Austin's. There's a picture of me that I wish I had in front of Austin's, addressing a crowd that ordinarily probably wouldn't want to hear from a politician, but the cause was proper. And so they were all excited that they were listening to me speak about what we're going to do to try to keep Austin's open. And ordinarily you wouldn't get that kind of crowd, because, you know, you could be the most liberal politician in the world, but the minute you get elected, some people on the left think you're no longer liberal, you know. How can you be liberal? You're part of the establishment. Well, there are people in the establishment, and then there are people in the establishment, right? Well, I always had a good relationship with the president of Austin's, because Wally was the constant. And Wally always told them, I think, pull them aside and said, let me tell you who that guy is in case you don't know. You know, and some knew, some didn't know. And so I'm thinking of all these faces, but we had a good relationship right from the beginning, because they knew that in me they had a fan. They had a person who not only, when we had earmarks, for instance, you know, earmarks is where a member of Congress can earmark money. Also was always on my list of places that would get dollars for special programs, for additions, for repairs of the buildings. In fact, and I'm thinking, I mean, I wish I would have taken time to write some of these things down, but I didn't. I did something also that I felt had to be done at Austin's. 7 years apart, I used my position on the Commerce, Justice, Science subcommittee, which I'm now back to being the top Democrat on, which oversees the Justice Department, the Commerce Department, the Census Bureau, but it oversees NASA. So I told NASA, can you fly a Puerto Rican flag on your next flight? And they did. Then I said, I have an idea. They should fly a Dominican flag. But it took a little longer to accomplish that. It took 7 years. So 7 years later, I had held on to the flag, Puerto Rican flag. 3 years later, we had at Osos a celebration to put both flags on display in Osos, and they're still there in the building. And what I did, which I thought was either ingenious or theatrical, is I had Dominican elected officials hold up the Puerto Rican flag, and Puerto Rican elected officials hold up the Dominican flag, you know, for a symbolic gesture of what it meant, the two
exactly.
islands. And honestly, it worked. And they're there now.
Yes.
The flags are at Oslo's, and those flags flew in outer space.
Wow.
How many people can say they have two flags that flew in outer space? I mean, space still has that kind of aura to us, that kind of excitement. You know,
like what's out there.
What's out there.
So
for a moment, there was a Dominican flag and a Puerto Rican flag, 7 years apart, but they were both presented to Oslo's. And when people said to me, what are you going to do with the flags? It was amazing. It was like an immediate reaction. I said, they'll have to go on display in Oslo's. That's where they belong.
But now that there is this wall project, I think it's...
takes a new meaning, right?
It takes a new meaning. And also, in relationship to what Oslo's is more relevant than ever, in a sense, the
right.
college. Which
right.
I think proves, you know, when I hear people... talk about all the history and all of the struggles that the college has gone through to stay open, to be open, and to thrive. And
right.
it takes a whole new meaning now.
Right. Also, it's always under attack. I don't know how it is now because, you know, the administration and new folks that work there, that serve there, have a better understanding than elected officials. But in those days, also, it was always under attack. It always had to prove itself. It always had to prove that, in fact, it was creating students that would be bilingual and not, you know, Spanish dominant. Not that there's anything wrong with being Spanish dominant, but that's not the purpose of the CUNY system. And so it had to defend itself all the time. And I remember one of the beautiful things about this whole thing that Garcia and I did is that when we were doing that outside in the state capital and outside of Oslo's and outside of the communities, and I think even in Puerto Rico, there were protests going on about keeping the school open. We were just the conduits for you know, we had the title, if you will,
yeah.
to work with the budget, but the work was being done out on the street.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And Oslo's has always been under attack. Oslo's always had to prove that it was producing the right student, that it was teaching people properly. I think that argument is gone. It's pretty much gone, but it was under a lot of attack.
Yeah.
Right. It was also at Oslo's, all these things coming back now, that I created what was known to people as the Serrano Scholars, but it had another name because we had a chairman who didn't want things named after yourself. I remember Dolores Fernandez had always spoken about naming, not the Savoy, but the one down the block. Or was it the Savoy after me? So, you know, because this chairman said, don't name things after yourself. Meanwhile, Byrd, the senator from West Virginia, had everything in West Virginia named
after him.
But I remember once, one of my gripes always was that in our foreign relations, we as Americans were missing a couple of things. And one of the things we were missing is sending folks to representatives in Latin American countries that had an understanding of that country they were being sent to. We didn't want the ugly American syndrome, you know. And as one who grew up here and who has great passion for these 50 states that I grew up in, you know, I mean, Puerto Rico is mi patria, and will always be the homeland. I love it to death, but New York has been home since I was a little. This is what I know. You you know, and this is where my parents are buried, you know, resting, and all my relatives, all my, except for a couple that stayed in Puerto Rico. So I wanted to create a program where hostels would prepare students who then would go on to Colombia to finish a special program that would help them get into the Foreign Service, or if not the Foreign Service itself, to be able to spread themselves out in public office and so on, with an understanding of what our role should be in Latin America. And so when we created that program, that one I knew from the beginning had to be at hostels. It was created, it was written about all over the nation. The fact that this community college, you know, had a program preparing people for Latin America. I'm not going to take credit for it, but I think I can give credit to hostels for it. I saw a change in the State Department and paying more attention in general, not with hostels necessarily, but in general, to the fact of preparing. Because I don't know how much the folks listening to this are aware of this, but most positions in a new administration or during the administration are filled by people who have some understanding of what they're going to be doing. Ambassadorships go a lot of times to people who donated a lot to the campaign. And they may not have it under, they may not even speak the language. There was once a story, I forget the story, about this actor being sent to John Gavin, I think it was, being sent to Mexico to be the ambassador. He took a lot of heat for it. He might have been a great lover of the Mexican people and an understanding person, but he took a leave because they wanted a State Department person. So I think the State Department has changed because of work hostels did during the time that program existed to the fullest. And I believe that sincerely.
Yeah.
The State Department, it's not new with the State Department now to think, well, maybe, you know, we should send to Venezuela somebody who lived in Venezuela for a while and who has a Venezuelan cousin or whatever, something of that nature. And also has played a major role. And that's the thing, Osos has played roles, whether it's being a place where you go for a medical test.
The dental hygiene. It's a free clinic, the only one in the world.
Exactly. Well, of all the things that I will say to you during this interview, the one that I could probably say with some strength is that was a creation that I was very much involved in. Everything else, a lot of people played a big role. But I thought that Hostos and Lincoln Hospital jointly should have a high school that they would prepare people for. And that high school had a name citywide.
Yeah.
But like old things, you know, some come to an end, some budgets ruin things.
Yeah. Well, I think in terms of Hostos, it was a matter of space, you know, because the college is small. I mean, it's outgrown, you know, its population.
What's the student body now?
It's almost 6,000, 7,000. It's a lot. And, you know, space is tight, which is one of the challenges that, you know, the college faces moving forward, you know, needing space.
Yeah.
College is going to thrive, and then especially in contrast with what's happening around in the area with all the new, you know, capital projects going on and all of that controversy. But more so in terms of like, will they have real estate?
Right.
If they don't catch it in time, if they're not, you know, are they going to have real estate around the area? And I think that's. A few people that I've spoken with have brought that up as something to be a little bit concerned about.
Yeah, you see, there have been different periods for the Puerto Rican and for the Latino community of growth. Certainly 1935,
mm-hmm.
when Puerto Ricans elect the first state assemblyman in East Harlem. That's a moment to remember in history. When a couple of folks were elected in the Bronx, Armando Montano, Luis Nine, that was important. When Badillo and Garcia in Congress, and I follow them in Congress, and all of a sudden we see Puerto Ricans and Latinos using, in many cases, the movement that had been started by Puerto Ricans to learn from and to join. They had the desire, they had the talent, but the organization was not there, and we had created the organizations. That's, you see the growth. But if I was to say, besides the political growth, where did we use that political growth the strongest? It's in that area. Lincoln Hospital, Hostos College, you know, you see it. You see where we were able to use political muscle to accomplish things. Lincoln was never going to be. Lincoln was there were people arrested in demonstrations. But there was also the relationships. Like, there was always a strong relationship with, between Hostos. All the presidents at Hostos, except maybe one or two to an extent, but all the presidents at Hostos understood that indeed it was a community college and that the word community was not an educational statement. It was an involvement statement. It was a political statement. I mean, Hostos, you haven't had a demonstration in New York about someone insulting anybody or an immigration reform or health care movement or women's rights or Latino rights without Hostos having a contingent involved. It was a lot of people took it as, wow, what is that? You know, I mean, Hostos is creating a way to get over from one place to another. And it showed ingenuity. It was symbolic also. It bridged different parts of the Grand Concourse together, and buildings that belong to the same institution were brought together. I remember sitting in the early days on the eastern part of the bridge. And, you know, we would have a meeting or something with students and so on, and I would sit there looking across at the other side, looking down on the concourse. And the concourse is still the concourse. It's majestic, you know, it's important. And there we were with our bridge. So I think the building of the bridge had a lot of symbolism in it, of uniting the different pieces of the campus. Because it was a unique campus. It wasn't the first of its kind, but it was one of the first of its kind. It was buildings. It was a tire factory that got turned into something. It was a ballroom that got turned into something else. It was people coming together and saying, we'll build a school anywhere we have to build it. So the bridge symbolized that coming together for me. It's still, every time I drive by it, or when I'm giving directions to members of Congress who want to come to Yankee Stadium, I say, well, you get off here, you go under the bridge in the community college, and then you just keep going and turn on 161st. The symbolism, in my opinion, many other people may have seen it other ways, but it wasn't easy to accomplish. It took a lot of maneuvering by the administration and, you know, the people who were in the city council and so on, and the government to get it done. But it symbolized a lot. It also continues to be different. I remember going to graduations. Young people, you know, early 30s or something, would graduate, late 20s, graduate. Then I always linger at the last graduation I go to because I know people ask me for photographs. And for a politician, it never hurts to take a picture, right? But I would linger at Hostos because it was Hostos. I would stay there till the end. And then you saw this change that you didn't see at other schools I went to. And that's so many of these folks, going back to my original comment, so many of these folks that were just graduated were now taking pictures with their children, including some who took pictures with their grandchildren. But it was beautiful because here you are in a neighborhood where you have to work hard to tell kids stay in school. And you're attending your mother's graduation. Do you have to say more? You know, she's your role model. If I can graduate at this age, so can you, you know?
Exactly. No excuses.